This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Ah, so very efficient. What? No fish left? Not to worry, the sea's filling up with jellyfish. So let's eat them.
To be a life scientist now is to explore despair. Arriving for the glory of the natural world, the experts find themselves chronicling the end of species, of the climate, of the ecosphere. I'm Alex Smith. We're going to dedicate this Radio EcoShock program to the sea, and to one of its lovers, Dr. Daniel Pauly, head of the Sea Around Us Project. His latest article, published in the New Republic magazine, September 28, 2009, is titled, Aqualypse Now, The End of Fish. I'll tell you where to find more Daniel Pauly online. We'll hear some clips from Dr. Pauly and an interview from one of his prize students, Dr. Jennifer Jacquet, at the University of British Columbia. Her paper shows that a third of our ocean harvest is being fed to pigs and chickens. That's right. In this upside-down world, pigs may not yet fly, but they have been morphed into major ocean predators, thanks to our industrial food complex. In the second half hour, we'll zero in on the mighty salmon. This popular food fish is challenged around the world by humans, their rivers dammed, their streams destroyed, our sewage and warming the oceans. No worry, we'll make our own farmed fish. Our guest, Catherine Stewart, on the Living Ocean Society, warns that aquaculture, from Scandinavia to Chile, is pushing out the sustainable wild stock. Horrible things are happening in places you and I never see. Our Radio EcoShock show for March 23, 2007, carried a 47-minute portrait of Dr. Daniel Pauly based on a speech he gave at the Vancouver Institute, among other sources. It's still a good introduction to the man and his work. I'll play you a couple of minutes from that, and then we'll go to more recent news from his institute.
Fish in the sea. Can we undo the damage before they're all gone?
Are we killing ocean life?
What would it take to be the granddaddy of fisheries researchers? On-site experience in many places, 500 papers published, working with a dedicated team and with other top scientists all over the world.
I wish I was a fisherman.
Then what if that top scientist sees and can now prove that humans are killing off their own food fisheries and creating giant deserts on the bottom of the sea? Now you understand the predicament of Dr. Daniel Pauly, director of the well-respected Fisheries Center at the University of British Columbia. He's almost a global citizen, French national, raised in Europe, worked decades in the Far East studying the fisheries from his base in the Philippines. In 1994, he accepts the post leading a dedicated research team on Canada's Pacific coast. This is a man and an institution that asks the big, tough questions. How do fish catches compare to those of the early 1900s? Are marine mammals a danger to fish stocks? Where do developed countries get fish for restaurants and their home tables once their own fish stocks have crashed? Are we killing off the world's fisheries?
Should I care?
Canada knows this situation very well. After its 500-year-old cod fishery collapsed in 1990 and hasn't come back. Is that an isolated incident?
I wish I was a fisherman.
The music clip in there was from Fisherman's Blues by the UK band The Waterboys. Find them at www.mikescottwaterboys.com. Now let's go to a teaser from the Daniel Pauly article that kicked me into action, again, calling on you to stave off disaster deep down in our oceans. This is the opener from Aqualypse Now. Our oceans have become the victims of a giant Ponzi scheme, waged with Bernie Madoff-like callousness by the world's fisheries. Beginning in the 1950s, as their operations became increasingly industrialized, with onboard refrigeration, acoustic fish finders, and later GPS, they first depleted stocks of cod, hake, flounder, sole, and halibut in the Northern Hemisphere. As those stocks disappeared, the fleets moved southward to the coasts of developing nations and ultimately all the way to the shores of Antarctica, searching for ice fishes and rock cods and, more recently, for small shrimp-like krill. As the bounty of coastal waters dropped, fisheries moved further offshore to deeper waters, and finally, as the larger fish began to disappear, boats began to catch fish that were smaller and uglier, fish never before considered fit for human consumption. Many were renamed so that they could be marketed. The suspicious slimehead became the delicious orange ruffy, while the worrisome Patagonian toothfish became the wholesome Chilean sea bass. Others, like the homely hokie, were cut up so they could be sold sight unseen as fish sticks and fillets in the fast food restaurants in the frozen food aisle. The scheme was carried out by nothing less than a fishing industrial complex, an alliance of corporate fishing fleets, lobbyists, parliamentary representatives, and fishery economists. By hiding behind the romantic image of the small-scale independent fisherman, they secured political influence and government subsidies far in excess of what would be expected, given their minuscule contribution to the GDP of advanced economies. In the United States, even less than that of the hair salon industry. In Japan, for example, huge vertically integrated conglomerates such as Taiyo or the better-known Mitsubishi lobby their friends in the Japanese Fisheries Agency and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to help them gain access to the few remaining plentiful stocks of tuna, like those in the waters surrounding South Pacific countries. Beginning in the early 1980s, the United States, which had not traditionally been much of a fishing country, began heavily subsidizing U.S. fleets, producing its own fishing industrial complex, dominated by large processors and retail chains. Today, governments provide nearly $30 billion in subsidies each year, about one-third of the value of the global catch. That keeps fisheries going, even when they have overexploited their resource base. As a result, there are between two and four times as many boats as the annual catch requires, and yet the funds to build capacity keep coming. The jig, however, is nearly up. In 1950, the newly constituted Food and Agriculture Organization, the FAO, of the United Nations, estimated that globally, we were catching about 20 million metric tons of fish, cod, mackerel, tuna, and so on, and invertebrates, lobster, squid, clams, etc. That catch peaked at 90 million tons per year in the late 1980s, and it has been declining ever since, much like Madoff's infamous operation, which required a constant influx of new investments to generate revenue for past investors. The global fishing industrial complex has required a constant influx of new stocks to continue operation. Instead of restricting its catches so that fish can reproduce and maintain their populations, the industry has simply fished until a stock is depleted and then moved on to new or deeper waters and to smaller and stranger fish. And just as a Ponzi scheme will collapse once the pool of potential investors has been drained, so too will the fishing industry collapse as the oceans are drained of life. That was courtesy of the New Republic magazine. Get the rest at www.tnr.com or find the direct link in my Radio EcoShock blog for November 26, 2009, ecoshock.org. It's time to talk about fish disappearing from the sea. No, not global warming this time or sewage pollution. I mean the fishing industrial complex. It grabs whole species for our dinner tables and other places that you might not expect. We're going to chat with one of the new generation of marine scientists, Jennifer Jaquette. She's an American now working on her PhD. Well, actually, she's got her PhD in Canada. She's part of the Sea Around Us project at the University of British Columbia. Jennifer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
You've hit the newspapers lately as the lead author of a new study on our declining fisheries. Where are all the fish going?
A lot of them are going to the human appetite one way or another. Most fish that we take out of the ocean, we use to feed to ourselves or something we eat. And that's, I think, what you were referring to, the very bizarre use of fish meal in pig and poultry production in addition to farm fish production. So it's a very strange market.
Well, why do they do it? They get these great big giant nets. They fill up huge trawlers or whatever, and then they get it and grind it all up and feed it to land animals that normally wouldn't eat that. Why are they doing it?
They're doing it for two reasons. One, it's cheap, and two, it's a protein source. So they can grow those animals like pigs and chickens more quickly on this very like high protein rich source of fish meal. And like I said, it's cheap because a lot of that fish meal is coming from the developing world, places like Peru, where they're catching these very small fish that really the humans could be eating themselves but aren't, because there seems to be higher demand from farm.
Is it sustainable? Can we keep doing this?
No, it's not sustainable, and it's definitely a waste. I mean, really, when we think of sustainability, we think things should stay the same. And back in the 1950s, almost no fish was going into the fish meal industry. Today, one in every three fish, 36% of all fish, being ground up and turned into fish meal. So it's not in any way sustainable. It's definitely a bit out of control, and we should not keep doing it if we want to have wild fish for the future.
And there's more going into the farm animals than, for example, sushi eaters in Japan, I hear?
Exactly. I mean, when you look at the global market, it's astonishing. Pigs and chickens around the globe are eating two times the amount of seafood as Japan. They're eating six times more seafood than America, even with our red lobsters and cruise ships. So it's hard to fathom, really, just how perverse this factory farming system is, but it really pretty bad for the oceans.
Well, for those who don't know, longtime fisheries researcher and I'd say expert Dr. Daniel Pauly is your mentor, and he's been mine too. But he's been extremely gloomy about the future of fish. In fact, his September 2009 article in the New Republic magazine is called "The End of Fish." Is it really that bleak?
Well, I've learned from the best, as he said. So I'm afraid it is that bleak. Unless we manage to sort of act quickly and act responsibly. And this requires a little bit of restraint, which humans have never been good at. But definitely we could turn things around if we just decided we wanted to close a bit more of the oceans to fishing, to remove some of the harmful fishery subsidies, government money that keeps fishing boats out there on the water when they shouldn't be, and just started enforcing some of the good legislation that we have on the books.
Can you tell us the title of your new work and where it's published?
Our new article is Conserving Wild Fish in a Sea of Market-Based Efforts. That's what it is. The title changed a bit from our original writing to the publication. And it's in the journal Oryx, which is the International Journal of Conservation.
How do you spell Oryx?
O-R-Y-X.
Okay, people can look that up if they want to. And I gather your paper adds a dimension of what actions work and maybe an evaluation of consumer market campaigns. I mean, obviously, if we can get people to stop eating the most endangered species, that doesn't stop this big conveyor belt going from the ocean to the farm feedlots. So what do we do?
I think you have it exactly right. I mean, what we are sort of saying in this article is that a lot of effort and money is going into trying to get consumers to change the way they consume fish, which is okay, but it's simply not going to work at the speed and the scale that we need it to. So when you as a consumer are going through the supermarket, you may be doing your best to make the right decisions, but when pigs and chickens around the globe are eating six times more seafood than Americans, how is any one American's decision going to make a difference? And that is really our point. So we'd rather see the efforts focused higher in the demand chain. If you want to hassle somebody, hassle your restaurant or your Costco, your Whole Foods or your Capers to do something different. We'd rather see consumers engaging more as citizens than simply as consumers with a supermarket basket, because it's not going to lead to these large-scale changes that we need.
Well, I think I really agree with you on that one. You know, jumping to a different point, it used to be hell getting information out of ocean experts. I can tell you, even when the research was paid for by the taxpayer, now at least a few scientists have a career path with nonprofit groups. I notice your funding came from the Pew Institute for Ocean Science. But also, you have a blog where you can express yourself pretty freely on a lot of issues, and that seems maybe natural to younger people, but for longtime investigators like myself, it's a miracle. Do you feel that scientific freedom of expression still needs to grow more?
Well, in a way, it needs to grow more, and in a way, it needs to grow very cautiously, because one thing that is so revered in science, obviously, is the peer review process, the fact that the study that came out of ours was vetted by four scientists who are experts in our field, which is really, and then there are nine authors on the paper, so it has some weight, whereas a blog, you know, goes through no editing process. It's sort of very free, and sometimes those two mediums are confused by the general public. You know, you publish a blog, you publish a paper, and they simply aren't the same thing. So I would like to see the freedom of expression grow. It's a wonderful thing to have scientists communicating directly with the public, but it's also requires a bit more discerning on the public's part because they don't carry the same weight, I don't believe.
Right. Is it a blog or is it a peer-reviewed paper? They're very different animals.
Yes, exactly.
The other big jump I've noticed, though, is more activism from scientists. Your blog is at scienceblogs.com/guiltyplanet, and it takes people to edgy Greenpeace campaigns that sometimes criticize big corporations. Is the increase in activism, and I'm not just talking about yourself, I've seen in a lot of climate scientists as well, is it coming from greater worry about the state of our oceans for the marine scientists?
I think Daniel Pauly, who you referenced earlier, really put it best to me when he said, you know, I turned to conservation because my lab was burning down, and if it was gone, what was I going to study? And so through the data, he's realized fisheries are really in trouble, and if we don't work to turn it around, there is no future for fishery scientists. And that's why scientists are getting involved, for the very, very selfish reasons oftentimes, because their jobs hinge on having these animals or the atmosphere existing in a relatively stable state to have, you know, any sort of future.
Yeah, well, I see you're planning a joint panel with Greenpeace for the 2010 meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science down in San Diego. Can you tell us what you're planning for that?
You're very, very on top of it. I just put that up yesterday. Yes, I'm hosting a panel on what reputation and cooperation can do for conservation. And I'm organizing that with John Hocevar at Greenpeace USA, not because I love everything Greenpeace does or they love everything I do, but because they're one of the very few groups using reputation in the marketplace to catalyze change. And this goes back to evolutionary theory and conservation theory. And so we're teaming up because, as I mentioned, we'd rather see people engaging as citizens, and we'd rather see them hassling further up their supermarkets or their restaurants rather than just worrying about themselves. And Greenpeace actually is putting that to work. They have a campaign that ranks supermarkets. They've had it in Canada. They've had it in the U.S. They have it in several other countries around the world. They rank supermarkets. They give them passing or failing grades. They give them tons of good media if they're good, bad media if they're bad, and they're affecting their reputation, and then they're going back and doing it the following year and the year after that. And they're using those supermarkets' reputation. They're pushing on them to get them to engage more with sustainable seafood and improve their buying practices. Rather than just pushing on a household, they're actually pushing on these big entities. And I really like that work. I support it from a theoretical and a practical perspective. And we're going to bring in some theoreticians from the evolutionary biologist side to talk about that as well.
I'm going to be talking with salmon aquaculture campaigner Catherine Stewart of the Living Ocean Society, but can you briefly tell us how you see fish farming using up these wild ocean stocks?
Well, one in every three fish taken out of the ocean is turned into fish meal. As I mentioned, 36%. Half of that goes to pigs and chickens, oddly, and the other half go to farm fish, which kind of makes sense. If you're farming fish eat fish, they would need some fish meal. So what we would suggest as a large market shift, we would rather see the market supporting herbivorous fishes or herbivorous aquaculture, things like mussels and scallops, than these large carnivorous floating hog factories, Dr. Pauly's called them, along, for instance, the BC coast, that require actually more fish as inputs than they produce.
And there's fish you can raise in ponds that, as you say, feed on algae or plant life that are far less harmful to the overall environment.
Exactly. We'd rather see that consumers and policy were pushing the market in that direction.
We're talking with ocean scientist Jennifer Jacquette from the University of British Columbia in Canada. Based on your research, I know you've talked about this a little bit already, but I'm hoping you'll expand on it, on what we should be doing to save what's left of the world's fish stocks.
I think that we should be putting aside, we stay at the Fisheries Center, and this is basically almost every faculty member here and postdoc like myself. We'd like to see 20 to 40% of the oceans set aside as no-take or marine protected areas. There are some disagreements over how much of that should be no-take, but right now less than 1% of the ocean is protected from overfishing. So on land, we've protected 12% of land. That's just crazy to think in the oceans there's almost no protection. And Rashid Zumaila, who's a co-author on the paper and the fisheries economist here at the Fisheries Center, is pushing hard to expose the amount of harmful fisheries subsidies, government money, that keeps fishing boats out on the water far past when they're profitable. So we would, as a policy recommendation, we would like to see that those harmful fisheries subsidies be removed in favor of free market principles, but also in favor of marine biodiversity.
As you know, the departing President George Bush created some important new marine protected areas, but those are out in the Pacific. But I learned from your Guilty Planet blog again that Obama has announced he won't create any more. What places closer to the U.S. should be protected first? Do you have some ideas on that?
Well, Obama did say he wouldn't protect more, which was unfortunate, but he might expand some of the existing marine protected areas. And he, one of his ideas is to expand the one up in Alaska, I think, off the Bering Strait, and that would be an excellent idea for lots of reasons, but mainly because that region is doing pretty well, and it's good to protect things while they're fairly pristine. So I would fully support the expansion of almost any marine protected area, and part of the work that we do here in the Sea Around Us project is to look at what areas would be would benefit most from protection. So maybe we'll be able to give you more insight to that in a year or so.
Good. We'll look forward to that. And I want to get into just sort of an opinion piece, I think, that you published in Seed Magazine of the new autobiography of the famed ocean explorer and TV personality Jacques Cousteau. That's dated November 3rd, 2009 at seedmagazine.com. Now, I'm a person who grew up looking at the underwater world with Cousteau, and it shocked me that younger ocean researchers have hardly heard of the man. Is that true?
I speaking from firsthand experience, it is true, unfortunately, and that was a real mystery to me. Why haven't I heard that much, and more importantly, why haven't I barely seen anything he's done? And the reason, I think, is as I mentioned in my book review, the fact that his legacy has sort of been left in shambles by a large family feud. And again, this sort of goes back to what we were talking about with reputation and how your name or your organization can live on. And it really requires a lot of cooperation, including among family members.
I think Cousteau will come back when the copyright laws let him in the estate, as you say. And that's some of the only widely known footage we have of the former richness of the sea compared with today. And that's important for that shifting baselines concept that comes out of your institute. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, so shifting baselines, again, was an idea posed by Daniel Pauly in 1995, the idea that every generation becomes sort of accustomed to a degraded state as being natural. So people out there, especially young people, would say, oh, the ocean looks great. I mean, there are lots of hammerheads swimming around or in the Galapagos Islands when I went diving, but they don't recognize that there used to be a far greater abundance because they don't have a historical perspective. And what you said about Cousteau having old footage is exactly right. He has footage from the 1940s in black and white from the Mediterranean, which is really astonishing, very cool. And that same area shot again in the 70s. And he really touched on this idea of shifting baselines with visuals and was very much a proponent of it. But again, that you said that footage has all been locked up with this family feud and it's not making its way into the public anymore.
Well, the shifting baselines, you know, I was at a dinner party with Dr. Suzuki, and someone told about going back to find their nephew heading out to Lake Ontario during the summertime. And, of course, he has to put on his wading shoes, and then he can go down to the shore. And I was there as a young man, and it was just bare feet only. And the difference is the zebra mussels that have invaded the Great Lakes. So there's the shifting baseline where the young person growing up today thinks, well, this pollution or these odd species are normal, and they're not.
Yeah, and I think it touches on why you said, you know, Dr. Polly's piece is kind of bleak in the New Republic, but older people naturally are more pessimistic because they have this historical perspective. Of course, things can also improve, and some people would, in L.A., for instance, would remind you that 20 years ago you could barely breathe, and air pollution has gotten so much better in L.A. thanks to good legislation. So sometimes things do get better, and we have to remember that as well.
Well, if we give the ocean a chance, for sure, it can regenerate a lot of life. We're hoping that we're heading for some nurseries that will protect what we've got left rather than just having a sea full of jellyfish. And that has been one of the predictions if we just keep going the way we're going, isn't it?
Yes. Again, just another thing here from the Fisheries Center, but jellyfish being the future of seafood, it's kind of unappealing, kind of strange, and captures the imagination in some bizarre sense. But we hope to not get entirely to that state. However, jellyfish harvests do seem to be on the rise, and there's growing market demand for jellyfish. So, well, we shall see.
Yeah, I really want my jellyfish and chips, not so much. Was Jacques Cousteau, do you think he was too extreme when he predicted that some deserts would develop on the seafloor?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, we see there have been research from other labs. Jane Lubchenco now, who's the head of NOAA under Obama, she does a lot of work with dead zones, showing that they're increasing on the rise around the world, and the largest one being in the Gulf of Mexico at the mouth of the Mississippi River, where all that nitrogen comes off. And they're creating exactly what you were saying, sort of deserts in the ocean of lifeless areas. And, of course, there's some life, like jellyfish and bacteria, that will thrive there, but nothing like what once existed.
Well, what's next for you, Jennifer, when it comes to research?
Maybe this is bleak as well, but I think I'm going to diversify out of fisheries a bit and into conservation dilemmas as a whole, because with fisheries, well, let's just say that the solutions are sort of there. All we need is the policy and the cooperation, and the science over the next 50 years will be more or less interesting depending on the choices that are made. So I'm hoping to get more into sort of the psychology of conservation and making, how do we create that cooperation and encourage it on a broad scale for climate change, overfishing, freshwater issues, all of these sort of broad common property resource issues.
Yeah, we need some answers. Why don't we change? We've got the science. We know what's going on, but we just keep on dragging everything we can get out of the sea and leaving not much.
I think that's the interesting question. Exactly.
Our guest has been one of the new generation of marine scientists, Jennifer Jacquette from the UBC Fisheries Center. Just Google Guilty Planet blog to find her online. I've bookmarked it as a lively place to keep up to date with ocean issues. Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Find this interview and more about the oceans at our website, ecoshock.org. I've covered scientist Dr. Daniel Polly whenever I can. He's one of our most experienced. Other fishery scientists use his calculations and his software to count the fish left on our oceans. Find his important speech to the Vancouver Institute, as I said, on our oceans page at ecoshock.org. That was delivered March 10th, 2007. Or you can find all those links in my Radio EcoShock blog entry for November 26th. Let's talk about salmon. It's the pink stuff on the plate. Does it matter where it comes from? Yes, indeed, as we'll learn from West Coast salmon campaigner Catherine Stewart. She's a campaign manager for the Living Ocean Society. Welcome, Catherine.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Just quickly on the basics, what kind of salmon do we eat, and where are the last wild stocks?
That's a pretty big question. We eat wild salmon and some people still eat farm salmon. Here in British Columbia and in Alaska, we have one of the greatest abundances of wild stocks remaining, and in Russia too, in far eastern Russia. So the Pacific Rim. And we have five native species of salmon in BC, the pinks, the chums, the sockeye, the chinook, and the coho. And then there's the Atlantic fish farms.
These are spectacular fish, though, and they start out in tiny streams, move out to that open ocean, and always they find their way right back again. Do we know where they're going when they're out at sea?
We don't know enough. We know, for example, that sockeye from the Fraser River will migrate out through the basin, up between Vancouver Island and the mainland coast of BC, travel up into Alaskan waters, go out into the North Pacific, and then return home. Sometimes along the west coast of Vancouver Island, often back down through the strait. But where they go when they're out in the North Pacific and exactly what food sources they're finding and how many other stocks are out there, we don't know enough. We need to do a lot more research to learn about salmon and about how they're being affected by oceanic conditions, including changes brought on by climate change.
Yeah, are they sensitive to heat? Does that affect them going up the rivers and that sort of thing?
They're very sensitive to heat. If water temperatures in the rivers start reaching 20, 22 degrees Celsius, salmon can die before they even reach their spawning beds. So if we see lowered water levels because there's less snowpack, because the climate is changing, then the water is going to warm up faster in the rivers and the salmon will be affected by that and often die.
And what are some of the other factors affecting our wild salmon these days?
Well, everything. I mean, if you think about a salmon emerging from a gravel bed way up the Fraser River, for example, and traveling hundreds of miles, their spawning habitat can be destroyed by pollution, by urban development, by logging to the banks of streams, silt and debris in the streams, by dogs and cattle and anything that might disturb the gravel beds. As they travel downstream, they can be affected by pollution from pulp mills on the river, people pouring waste oil or antifreeze down the drain on the street corner often don't realize they're pouring that directly into the habitat of our wild salmon. And then, of course, there's the level of fishing pressure, sea lice and disease transfer from open net cage salmon farms, climate affecting upwelling of nutrients in the ocean. There are so many risk factors that affect the survival of wild salmon. And yet wild salmon are so important to the functioning of our coastal ecosystem. They not only feed the orcas, the killer whales, the eagles and the grizzly bears and even the coastal wolves, but they also feed the old growth forests. Studies that have been done at University of Victoria indicate that up to 70% of the nitrogen that fuels the growth of those magnificent 1,000-year-old cedar trees comes from the carcasses of the salmon that are dragged into the riparian zone by predators.
So we really need these fish, but as people who are going to restaurants, we think to ourselves, well, we can always just raise salmon in fish farms. That's called aquaculture. And that's what you're working on, I take it.
Yes, that's right. And there is nothing fundamentally wrong with the concept of aquaculture. The problem is the way that we're practicing it right now. The large commodity scale industrial feedlots that we place right on the migratory routes of our wild salmon are causing myriad problems.
And where do we get the food for those salmon?
Largely from industrial meal fisheries. We fish anchovies, sardines, often in the Southern Ocean, in Peru, for example, or in the North Sea, if in the case of European fish farms. And those fish, which could feed humans and which are an integral part of the ocean food web, are ground up into meal and oil and used to feed carnivorous fish, such as salmon, as well as pigs and chickens and other farm animals.
And where are these aquaculture farms located? What countries are we finding them?
Well, the biggest producers in the world are Norway, Chile, Canada, the East Coast and the West Coast of Canada, and then there are other smaller producers. Scotland, Ireland, New Zealand is beginning to get into salmon farming. But yeah, Norway, Chile, and Canada are the big three.
And are they local operations or big multinational companies?
Big multinationals. 90% of the fish farms on the British Columbia coast are owned by three large Norwegian multinationals. And Chile as well. Huge concentration of the same companies in Chile.
So wherever you go in the world, you can keep running into the same Norwegian companies running these farms?
Pretty much. You know, there are some exceptions. They don't have as big a presence in the east coast of Canada, for example, as they do on the west coast or in Chile or in Scotland. But they do certainly dominate the global industry.
Is it true that Norway had to poison some of the rivers to get rid of diseases brought by farmed fish?
Yes, quite a while ago. They've had problems, serious problems with escapes because they're raising these fish in net cages that are suspended in the water. The nets can be damaged by predators. They can be damaged just by human error. They can be torn in storms. You know, anchors can slip off a cliff and pull the corners of the cages underwater. You get all kinds of reasons why large escape events can happen, and thousands of fish will spill out of these pens and go into the rivers. If the fish are diseased, they can spread that disease to the wild stocks. And so it was probably, must have been 15 years ago or so, where Norway had such a problem with disease outbreaks in the wild stocks that they dumped rotenone in a couple of their river systems, just killed everything, and started trying to rebuild it from scratch.
Something we don't want to have happen here on Canada's west coast. You mentioned sea lice earlier. What is that threat and how do companies try to handle it?
Well, sea lice are a naturally occurring phenomena, and the aquaculture industry will always say, well, you know, what's the problem? You'll find sea lice on wild salmon. Well, you will. But when an adult mature salmon returns to its natal stream to spawn and enters fresh water, the sea lice, which are just a parasite that attach themselves to the salmon, will fall off and die because they can't survive in fresh water. And there would be no host for them. Once the salmon went into the fresh water, there were no other fish that they could attach themselves to survive. Well, then you take a large industrial fish farm and you plop it right down in the mouth of the river and you cram it full of 750,000 foreign, non-indigenous Atlantic salmon in the Pacific Ocean, and you raise them in these packed conditions. Then when the returning wild salmon pass by the farms, the sea lice will transfer to the farms. But then it's a perfect host for a parasite. It's like a smorgasbord. And they breed and the populations of lice explode and all the eggs and the females with egg chains on them go looking for another host. And when the tiny little baby wild salmon, a pink salmon, for example, when it emerges from its spawning gravel is no bigger than my little finger. When they come out into what would once have been clean ocean waters with no parasites, they run into clouds of sea lice that infect them and often kill them. Most of the time will kill them if they get heavy lice loads. And if they don't kill them outright, they make them much more vulnerable to predators. I mean, other salmon like coho will prey on tiny pink salmon. And if the salmon are weakened by parasite attached to their body, then they're much more likely to fall victim to predators. So we've replaced a natural, healthy, functioning system with one that is putting at risk the survival of the wild stocks. To treat the lice on the farms, the farmers generally use a chemical called emimectin benzoate. Its manufacturer recommends against its use in aquatic environments, but they do get a special permit to use it to treat the lice on the fish, on their farmed fish. Problem, of course, is that sea lice are a crustacean, and using this chemical in the feed in the salmon farms, we don't know how it's affecting other crustaceans in the area of the farms, such as prawns.
We're talking with Catherine Stewart, campaign manager for the Living Ocean Society at livingoceans.org. Catherine, before you joined the aquaculture campaign, you spent 17 years with Greenpeace in Canada. How would you compare your successful negotiations with the big forest companies for the Great Bear Rainforest with the current efforts in the salmon industry?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I think that there's a cycle that happens in campaigns where you spend a lot of time raising awareness about the problem. You start to build pressure on the industry and government demanding change. And you get to a point where the pressure is so sustained and so serious that the industry has no choice but to deal with it. And it's often then that you enter into negotiations. And we're seeing that same pattern that emerged in the forest campaigns in BC repeated in our campaigns to get the salmon farming industry to clean up its act. So we are now negotiating with BC's largest producer, one of the big Norwegian three, Marine Harvest, looking at doing some collaborative science, alternating fallow routes where farms are emptied during the outmigration period. But these are interim measures, and what we really need is to get all these farms out of the water and into closed containment systems, either land-based or floating closed tank systems. You need to separate farms from the natural marine ecosystem, because lice are only one of the problems with farms. They get permits to shoot and kill predators such as seals and sea lions. The predators can also get tangled in the nets and drown. They dump all of the fish feces and the waste feed on the ocean bottom, smothering it. The list goes on and on and on. I mean, the bottom line is that people eating farm salmon should tell their grocer, their restaurant, their favorite restaurant that's serving it, that they do not want to eat this product until the industry cleans up its act.
And so that's why you have the slogan Farmed and Dangerous. Can you tell us about the partnership that Living Oceans has with other nonprofit organizations working on this campaign?
Sure. Well, farmedanddangerous.org is the website of the Coastal Alliance for Aquaculture Reform, which involves other groups such as the David Suzuki Foundation, Georgia Strait Alliance. There are five groups in total that join together to try and force this industry to change. The industry and its supporters often characterize us as anti-aquaculture, but that's not the case. We know that aquaculture has a place in a world where wild fish stocks are in serious and profound decline, and where a growing population is demanding more and more fish protein. Aquaculture does have a place, but it has to be done properly and in a way that doesn't threaten the critical ecosystem functions of our natural environments.
The First Nations people have depended on salmon for thousands of years. What is their part in this picture now?
Well, I think First Nations are in a challenging position. Many of them strongly object to the incursion of fish farms into their traditional territories. They're seeing elevated levels of mercury and rockfish around the salmon farms. Their clam beds are being destroyed by waste and fecal matter from the salmon farms. I mean, it's not just their wild salmon that's being affected. It's all of their traditional marine foods resources. So many of the First Nations do not want the farms in their territory unless they're in closed contained systems. Some, however, some communities are dealing with unemployment of 90%, and they're looking for any way of keeping food on the table and people in jobs. And so they have agreed to tolerate the fish farm industry in their communities, although I have to say in most instances not with a great deal of enthusiasm. And they play a critical role in the fight because in British Columbia in particular, First Nations have never ceded their territories. And so they are, the government, the federal and provincial governments are obliged to consult with, and now the Supreme Court has ruled, consult with and accommodate the interests of First Nations. They're a key player in trying to force change on this unsustainable industry.
And where is the government? It's supposed to be an impartial regulator, but is it really an industry booster?
Very much so, unfortunately. Both the federal and the British Columbia provincial government have been huge supporters of the aquaculture industry. I think they find fish in pens much easier to manage than wild salmon. And they have advocated for the industry, subsidized it, promoted it. A lot of our tax dollars go to boosting the sales of farm fish product. About 80% of the fish that the aquaculture industry in BC produces, the salmon, goes to the U.S. marketplace. So U.S. consumers have a huge role to play in this. They need to ask when they're in a restaurant or a grocery store, is this farmed or wild? And if it's farmed, they need to tell their retailer, don't sell this product until the industry changes.
You're talking about consumer choice here, but Jennifer Jacquette suggested that NGOs should go past that and go after the big multinational food companies and the fishing companies. Are you doing that?
We are doing that, actually. For a long time, CAR has had a campaign where we've been pressuring major grocery retailers, such as Safeway, to stop carrying farm salmon, or if they're not willing to stop immediately, to push the industry for a better product, to demand change. I mean, the retail sector is in a position to push their suppliers for a better product. And that's exactly what we saw on the forest front when companies like Home Depot started saying, we don't want to be responsible for the clear-cut devastation of ancient old-growth forests, some of the last temperate rainforests on Earth. We don't want to be a party to that. We want the industry to change its practices and provide us with a more sustainable product. So we're making some gains. Compass Canada, for example, is a supplier who provides food services to institutions right across the country, the City of Ottawa, the University of Ottawa, large healthcare facilities and educational institutions, and they have completely stopped selling farm salmon. And they've sent a very loud and clear message to the industry that they want a better product. They want to buy salmon from closed contained systems, not salmon that is killing our wild salmon and harming our oceans. Other retailers are adopting sustainable seafood policies. Overweighty in Western Canada is another example of that. And increasingly in the United States, the Food Marketing Institute have banded together the major retailers such as Costco and others to look at how they can adopt better policies. I think there's a risk, and consumers need to be very aware of what we might call the greenwashing labels. The industry, the aquaculture industry, knows that there's a trend towards sustainability and are coming up with all sorts of bogus certification schemes. And, you know, they're industry labels. There's no transparency. You can't find out what standards the industry is being held to. It's just, you know, a nice little green stamp that the industry gives itself and tries to claim that these are ecologically better than open neck cages, but they're not. And we're working through a process right now that World Wildlife Fund instituted several years ago called the Salmon Aquaculture Dialogues that involve NGOs from around the world, the key producing regions of salmon farming, and the major corporations to try and come up with some credible standards that would eventually lead to a legitimate certification. So for now, it's buyer beware.
Right. Well, I want to turn the mic over to you and say, is there something that you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, that's a big question. yeah. Well, I think the key thing to remember is wherever farm salmon is coming from, whether it's coming from Chile or whether it's coming from the Loch Duart farms in Scotland that like to market themselves as better and more sustainable, whether it's coming from British Columbia or New Brunswick, open net cage salmon farming is harming our wild fish, it's harming our oceans, it's killing marine mammals. It's a bad industry that needs to change. And consumers and you listeners out there are the only ones who can really make it happen. So speak up. If it says fresh salmon on your menu, say, is this farmed or wild? And tell the retailer, tell the restaurant the costs of farm salmon. The price may look attractive, but the costs are devastating.
We've got the goods on salmon from Catherine Stewart. Plug yourself in at livingoceans.org and farmedanddangerous.org. This is Radio EcoShock. You can find more on our threatened ocean life at our website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for tuning in. Salmon aquaculture, as we've heard, is simply unsustainable. Here's what Dr. Daniel Pauly said about it. But Dr. Pauly says aquaculture is not the answer. It cannot replace declining fish stocks, and aquaculture as understood by North Americans and Europeans, that is, fish farms raising salmon or trout, are terminally wasteful of ocean resources. Our style of aquaculture takes large amounts of perfectly edible small fish and concentrates them in high-value fish like salmon.
There are people who believe that aquaculture is the solution to all of this problem. And the growth of aquaculture, it grows very fast, aquaculture, and it's a solution to the problem. But first of all, most aquaculture, two-thirds of the world aquaculture is in China. This is very strange. Two-thirds of the world aquaculture production is in China. And now I've read in Sofia, in a state of the world fisheries, that they're actually beginning at FAO to doubt that China has this monster aquaculture. The second thing is the fish that are grown by China is mainly mollusks and cyprinids, carps-like animals. That is, they don't have to feed them. Because the salmon, when we talk aquaculture here, we actually mean salmon. In Europe, they would mean salmon and bass and so on, fish that are carnivores that must be fed with fish meal. And when we talk about aquaculture helping produce, helping feed the world, this is true for mollusks and cyprinid. They can be added to the world catch, the world marine catch. But if you're talking salmon, they cannot be added to the world catch because the part of the world catch is needed to produce salmon. And more precisely, a huge amount is needed. This much is needed, is right now used for growing animals, is wasted on pigs, is wasted on chicken, on salmon. And I will explain why I say wasted. I would not have 1 month ago, 2 months ago, but I now think it's wasted. Now, I say wasted because for pigs and chicken, you can give them other feed. And I say wasted on salmon because salmon, if you eat them for the taste or if you eat them for the omega-3 fatty acid, you would get as much of a taste and far more omega-3 fatty acid if you ate the feed directly. And now I'm not going to show you the feed. That is salmon food. That is what I ate in Peru in an initiative that began by a friend there the week of anchoveta, where for the first time people have been convinced to try to eat anchoveta as opposed to put them in a grinding them up, and she got even the President of the Republic to eat them on TV in his palace. And there is a sea change in the perception. All of a sudden, people realize that they have been wasting this resource because it's wasted when it's fed to a salmon because it can be eaten right there. Now, you Canadian, you think, I'm not going to eat this fish. Well, you are actually eating crab with a K, surimi. You're eating all kind of crab, actually, that is made from scrapes of fish and stuff. We're already eating that stuff. It's far worse than eating this. The Spaniards, the Italian, who know something about fish, they love this fish, and they will buy them. And that, hopefully, will be competition for the fish meal industry. And I hope it will go broke. And if it does, there will be no more salmon. You will have to eat this. But they are good, I'm telling you. Here, look at this, sushis, anchoveta sushis and so on. Very nice.
We could go on and on about the risks from fish farming. Just two quick examples. Toronto's Globe and Mail newspaper reported November 23rd that Asian carp were poised to invade the Great Lakes. DNA tests showed that this invasive species, which threatens to kill off most other food fish from the lakes, has bypassed a fence set up by the Army Corps of Engineers. That fence was supposed to stop the Asian carp from traveling from the Mississippi River to the lakes. The Asian carp was brought to the United States to control algae in catfish farms. Now it's poised to wreak major changes in both Canada and the United States. Or how about this one? Some aquaculture operations have been feeding dried cow blood to the fish. Now scientists are hurriedly testing to see if that practice risks transmitting Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, you know, mad cow disease, through farmed catfish. See the article in Science Daily, November 6, 2009. Learn more about Dr. Pauly's work. His ocean modeling system is called EcoPath. See www.ecopath.org. The online encyclopedia of fish types he helped establish is FishBase at fishbase.org, and the global mapping of fisheries trends is available at www.searoundus.org. That's searoundus.org. Way back on October 22, 2008, Daniel Pauly listened to a detailed listing of the Canadian government's failures to protect endangered ocean species. That was a breakthrough talk by a top government advisor, Dr. Jeff Hutchings. You can download his Lament for a Nation's Oceans, as recorded by Radio EcoShock, from the Oceans page at our website, ecoshock.org. When it comes to protecting the oceans, Canadians have a wretched record. The U.S. isn't much better. The Europeans have already stripped their cupboards bare and are hunting elsewhere. The Japanese steal fish from people all over the world. It's sad and it's madness. By the way, the latest ocean science questions why so many ocean species died during the great extinction periods on land, like the time the dinosaurs died and the four previous great extinctions. Many scientists now believe the ultimate cause of massive marine die-off was ocean acidification, derived from excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
There is a very convincing argument was made that all massive extinction on Earth, the five big extinctions on the Permian and so on, including the one that hit us in 65 million years ago that ended up the dinosaurs and stuff, was followed by the disappearance of massive part of the oceanic fauna and flora. And the author attributed to not temperature, not the nuclear winter because of the sun light not reaching the earth and so on, because of the dust in the atmosphere and so on, but acidification that followed.
Finally, what does an ocean scientist say? Once he knows that democratic governments fund the industrial fisheries, the very machine that strips our ocean stock down to nothing, Dr. Pauly was asked to comment, and this is what he concluded.
So the next step is thinking there is a deficit, a democratic deficit. How come somebody can lie like that? I didn't say it. Jeff said it. But we all know this is true. They lie. And how come they can get away and we re-elect them? We have a deficit, a democratic deficit. And that implies then that other methods are used than every 3 or 4 years voting or not voting or whatever. That implies that the need for a civil engagement in NGOs that raise hell. Because clearly they have decided that they would not listen. The scientists tell them the stuff, here it is. And then they say, I don't give a hoot. And that's it. So you have to raise hell. And raising hell, one cannot do that individually. There were anarchists 100 years ago to blow up bombs and stuff that doesn't bring anything. So one has to be organized, an NGO, and raise hell through NGOs. I cannot say anything else, really, without organized, articulated movements that raise hell. Minister Hans will continue to do his things, and his successor will do that, and the successor of his successor. And the parade of nonsense has gone on in full knowledge of everything, and it goes on and on. So that one has to say no to, and that can be only in the form of joining NGOs and raising hell. So let's hazel together. Thank you very much.
Join the people who care about what is happening in our oceans. Find your regional nonprofit, join them, donate, help, organize, or we lose the lush gifts of the sea. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock.
The sea is my lifeline, the shore is my home. I've been to your city, so I didn't stay long. I stared at the bright lights, the dark city waves. I'll tell you that's not for me, no, I couldn't stay. Singing love. Tough.